I'm Roger Baker, Executive Director of the Stratfor Center for Applied Geopolitics at RAIN, a global center of excellence for geopolitical intelligence and analysis. Learn how you can put geopolitics to work for your organization at RAINnetwork.com.
Hello and welcome to RAIN's Essential Geopolitics podcast. On April 10th, President Biden met with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida in a half-closed-door meeting, followed by a joint press conference at the White House. According to a joint statement that was later released, the meeting covered China's efforts with Taiwan and in the South China Sea, North Korea's nuclear program, advancing AI technologies, and green energy, among other topics. Here to help boil down some of the most significant takeaways from the summit is RAIN's Asia-Pacific analyst, Chase Blazek. Hi, Chase. Thanks for joining me
today.
Hey, Emma.
Good to talk to you.
Can you explain what this meeting is indicative of for Japan and the U.S.'s ongoing military relationship?
Yeah, sure. So as you point out, there was some of the geopolitical conversation there and a little bit of industrial cooperation. But a lot of that was sort of common fare. And you already mentioned the highlights there, talking about opposing any Chinese changes to the status quo around Taiwan or South China Sea, opposing the North Korea's missile program development, and then cooperation on development of advanced technologies, including Japan's participation in the U.S. floating offshore Windshot program, and the U.S. goal of having two Japanese astronauts become the first non-Americans to step foot on the moon, with the unspoken goal there being beating China to that milestone. But yeah, the most important milestones or topics, I should say, from this summit were the defense matters. A lot of them were sort of previewed before the meeting, but we got a readout that was a lot more detailed, included cooperation on command and control infrastructure, you know, what to do during contingencies in cooperation between the American and Japanese militaries, given the heavy presence of U.S. bases and personnel in Japan, as well as Japan's work in co-production and co-development of missiles with the United States, so the United States doesn't have to take quite such a large role in that. Looking at whether or not Japan could join on to the AUKUS Defense Pact in a limited capacity in Pillar 2, which would maybe be in technological and research collaboration, such as on underwater drones and artificial intelligence in the military. And then a couple of trilateral developments announced. So a trilateral annual military exercise with the UK, the US, and Japan, and looking into or exploring, as they put it, trilateral cooperation with Australia and Japan and the United States on automated combat aircraft cooperation.
And can you talk about what you think this will maybe mean for South Korea and for the overall sense of China's containment?
Yeah, so the geopolitical implications here are where it gets interesting. There's also the Japan element of it. So you talked about a couple there, but I'll start with the Japan element. This has long been a very strong partnership, the U.S.-Japan partnership. It's often put as the most important U.S. partnership, especially in the region, but in general. And that's because of the longstanding presence of U.S. military personnel there and the role that Japan plays as sort of the first defender of the U.S. in the Western Pacific, because the U.S.'s national security goal for decades has been to never have to bring any wars to U.S. shores. So part of that involves having partners far afield. So there's obviously the U.S. holdings in Guam in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but even better than that is having quite a bit of military cooperation with Japan, which is close to North Korea and China and Russia, all national security concerns for the United States. So a lot of the cooperation that was fleshed out in this summit shows just how important Japan is for U.S. national security goals in general, but also in the Pacific, given that a number of these trilateral cooperations I mentioned and that the summit mentioned, U.S.-UK, Japan, U.S.-Australia, Japan, U.S.-South Korea, Japan, they all have the U.S. and Japan in them. So this is indicative, in my mind, of Japan playing the hub to the U.S. hub-and-spoke model of these multilateral defense engagements in the region. To your point, though, this goes beyond Japan. Obviously, there's implications here for South Korea and China. For South Korea, it's not bad for sure, but Seoul has been working on sort of upping its stance, so to speak, in the U.S.'s military hierarchy, such that Japan is not clearly number one here. And that matters because South Korea wants the U.S. to value the South Korean military partnership just as much, if not more, than the Japanese partnership, because South Korea has very different priorities. They're most concerned about, in Seoul, North Korea, whereas Japan, like the United States, is most concerned about China here. So it is further indicative, with all of these trilateral engagements and pretty detailed commitments to defense cooperation with Japan, just how much the U.S. continues to prioritize partnerships with Japan, not at the exclusion of South Korea, but above and beyond some of the cooperation going on with South Korea. From China's perspective, this is, of course, just one more instance of the United States using its partnerships in the region to expand this, you know, quote-unquote containment net. China perceives, or I should say that the Chinese Communist Party perceives that the United States is trying to use defense partnerships with the likes of Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Australia, you name it, to contain China's economic growth, so with things like restrictions on Chinese access to advanced chips, but also to contain China's military growth and its sphere of influence security-wise by having these partnerships, by pushing back against Chinese goals surrounding Taiwan and surrounding the South China Sea. And so from China's perspective, this is just one more instance of just how much the U.S. is clearly committed to trying to contain China's growth. And that matters for Japan because China tends to treat those countries that it perceives are trying to contain China pretty poorly in business and in personal relationships. And what I mean by that is Japan is the country that, besides perhaps the United States, but also potentially beyond the United States, China reserves the most severe economic and legal restrictions for Japan. And what I mean by that is, of course, export restrictions, but also arbitrary inspections into Japanese companies and exit bans on Japanese employees and executives trying to leave China. I believe there was that Astella Pharmaceuticals group where one of their high executives, a Japanese executive, was exit banned from China. So for Japan, this Chinese ire matters beyond just, oh, we know Beijing's mad at us, because this can really impact the Japanese business environment here.
Not to spend too much time on South Korea, since I know we have a lot to cover today, but can you touch a little bit on the country's recent election and how and if the results of the election can figure into the relationship between the Japan and the U.S. and just the general dynamics overall in Asia?
Yeah, sure. We'd be glad to. So the recent election was not super high stakes for South Korea's relationship with Japan and the United States, simply because it was a legislative election and foreign policy is largely driven by the president in South Korea. So he's got his one constitutionally limited 1 5-year term. He doesn't step down until 2027. So really, no matter what happened in the South Korean legislative election, South Korea's policy toward the United States and Japan would remain the same. And that includes military cooperation against North Korea. South Korea is expanding defense exports in general, but also more and more statements coming out of South Korea that align with Japanese and U.S. statements about not wanting China to change the status quo around Taiwan and the South China Sea. So from that aspect, luckily, not a lot is changing, but it is indicative of the potential for change in the South Korea-U.S.-Japan trilateral relationship in the future. And that's because the ruling party, or the party of President Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea, they lost, and they lost pretty handily. So going into 2027, which is the next presidential election, both the conservative and the liberal parties in South Korea, with the conservative party supporting the president, they're going to look to put forth new leaders and to sort of move on from the legislative elections and also move on a bit from Yoon, because he's limited to one term. And so it is indicative, these elections, not of an imminent change in the U.S.-South Korea defense partnership or the trilateral partnership with Japan, but of that potential for change in the future. Because unlike South Korea, Japan really doesn't tend to change parties that much. It's only been two times in recent history and just for a couple of years in which the conservative Liberal Democratic Party was not in control, and that's the party that values very highly close military relations with the United States. So the way this ties into our conversation about the Kishida-Biden summit is this underlines the value of the Japanese partnership to the United States, because there's really not likely to be much political tumult that could ruin the U.S.'s efforts to expand its military footprint in the Asia-Pacific, resulting from a change of parties in Japan. It's possible, always possible in Japan, but less likely than in South Korea. To show that it's possible, I mean, the ruling party in Japan is not doing fantastic right now. They've had both the Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, and the ruling Liberal Democratic Party have had support ratings among the public of below 20%, I believe, for a number of months. And that's typically a very bad sign for the prospects of a party. But luckily in Japan, the one thing you can count on is the one group less organized and in more chaos than the ruling party is the opposition. So it's possible Japan could change government in the future, but it tends to be a very disorganized process. They're only in office for a couple of years, and they're back out, and then the ruling Liberal Democratic Party is back in for another, decade or two. So from the United States perspective, the relative stability of the Japanese political environment is very attractive when picking a partner to base all of the United States defense partnerships in the region on for the foreseeable future.
Wow, I didn't know that. That makes a lot of sense. So then, I guess, turning to China, what can we expect from China, like response-wise and structurally, like overall, what's probably going to happen in the region just as China responds to the kind of improvement of the relationship between Japan and the U.S.?
Yeah, thankfully, or I guess in China's case, unfortunately, these kinds of developments of, U.S. president meets with fill-in-the-blank Asian leader, these are becoming quite common because, as I mentioned, the U.S. is trying to branch out and deepen and expand its defense partnerships in the region. So China doesn't feel the need to respond to every one of these, at least in the short term, but in the long term, certainly. China will continue to deepen its relationships with authoritarian countries like Russia and North Korea and Iran, as it perceives that the United States and its Western European and increasingly Asian partners are trying to contain China. And that's partly to have sort of a backstop to push back against these containment nets militarily, and to have partnership in groups like the UN. If China's got these other partners that Beijing knows dislike the West just as much as Beijing does, it's very valuable to push back against U.S.-driven initiatives in the UN and other international fora. It'll also, double down Beijing's commitment. They don't need more reason for this. This is already sort of the trajectory we're on. But it further convinces Beijing of the necessity of planning for a Taiwan contingency in the future. It doesn't really move up timelines, so to speak. But Beijing is quite concerned, if you look at it from their perspective, from a basic national security perspective, as the United States is beefing up its relationships with Japan and the Philippines and South Korea and Australia, all this sort of ring fence around China's eastern coast, Beijing has for long and is increasingly fearful of the U.S. using Taiwan as sort of a springboard and the surrounding Philippines and Japanese islands as a springboard into attacking China. That may or may not be the U.S. goal here, but if you're China and you're looking at your national security, knowing that the U.S. is closing in around Taiwan and could potentially use that as a base for, launching strikes into the interior of China is a very real security threat, especially if the U.S. could use something like Taiwan to cut off the north-south trade going along China's eastern coast, which is critical for its economy. So from China's perspective, this Kishida Biden summit, all of these trilaterals, the new military exercises going on, and the U.S. commitments to increasing command and control and missile production in Japan. This is all indicative of a reason why China needs to prevent in the future this sort of defense net of the United States from being mobilized to use Taiwan for ill toward China, so to speak.
Well, thank you, Chase. It's great to hear your insights on this.
Yeah, sure thing, Emma.
You can read more of Chase's analyses from RAIN by subscribing to RAIN's geopolitical intelligence products. Our suite of products and solutions allow clients to access the insights and analyses they need to make more informed decisions. You can sign up or learn more at our website, rainnetwork.com. That's RANE network.com. I'm Emma Kami. Thanks for listening.